So welcome to another episode of Berkman Insights. This is our podcast series on lessons learned from the last downturn. My name is Steve Lord. I'm New York team lead for Berkman Associates and manage a team of CFOs here in the city. And I'm joined today by Dan Rosenbaum. He's one of the most experienced CFOs we have on board our group here in New York with Berkman Associates. He's a highly experienced C-suite executive. He has decades of experience in both Fortune 500 companies and startups, venture-backed startups. Dan has a very strong life sciences and manufacturing expertise, and he's extremely adept at the kind of forward-thinking, high-level analysis, forecasting, and reporting that tend to be hallmarks of very strategic CFOs. So thanks for joining us, Dan.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So as you know, the idea behind this podcast series is to help CEOs and management teams understand the best practices, do's and don'ts of navigating the kind of crisis that we're in right now. And as we joke a lot, you and I, that this is our third or fourth once-in-a-lifetime experience or crisis. So what we're drawing is people together who were in the trenches before, have gone through significant crisis-type events at prior companies, and just trying to glean tips and tricks from them about how CEOs that maybe haven't done this before should approach what they're doing and even potentially a life beyond the current crisis. So, you know, you were on the firing lines during at least one of these prior once-in-a-lifetime crises. Which one stands out to you, and what was the scene at that company and what you were doing?
The prior one probably for me is going to be the financial crisis in 2008. And I remember very distinctly, I was in a Fortune 500 company at the time, and it just seemed like there was a complete pause for a few days of, you know, all activity. Markets kind of froze up. And to see that level of business cessation at a global company like that was shocking. It's just completely shocking. There was this level of uncertainty of how long does this last, and what's, of course, the impact on our operations as a global company. So a huge amount of uncertainty, and then things wound back into action.
Do you think part of what that was just simply people trying to get their bearings and assess, you know, like there's that in any crisis situation, there's a moment where something is so far afield of what we are used to seeing and doing that it takes us a minute to process just how different it is and what to do with that new information. Do you think even at a Fortune 500 company, institutionally, it has to do the same thing?
Yeah, I think so, because your customers hit the pause button, even if it's momentarily, and it ripples through everything. You know, whether it's sales that are in the pipeline, whether it's receivables and the ability to collect cash, whether it's more in the, you know, financial markets freezing up and banks freezing up. Certainly in that case, for a global company, when the banking system starts to freeze up or hit the pause button, it ripples through everything. And so I think part of it was just, how long is that going to last? When does it unfreeze? Are you going to be able to conduct business? And I think in that case, the answer was pretty quickly. But you know, for that period of time, you don't know. And it was certainly, in my case, you know, not like anything that I'd seen in the past. So you just, this level of uncertainty, but hey, what playbook do you consult here to see what happens next?
Right. Actually, that's a good segue into one of our questions is, what stands out about the current crisis compared to that one or your other prior experiences? Because there are some significant similarities, and then there's some differences as well.
Yeah.
Like, what do you see the same? What do you see different?
Well, certainly the level of uncertainty and the cautiousness, but I actually think in this case, there's more differences than similarities. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, it's a lot more complicated because of the combination of not just economic financial system questions, but also just general healthcare, health concerns on a global pandemic and even socioeconomic factors. And then you layer on top of that, not just in the US, but even in other countries, it's become highly politicized on top of that. And so the complexity of what really in this case needs to be coordinated responses, it's more, I think the level of coordination needed is much higher than perhaps what we saw in the financial crisis and even earlier. And the idea that the success of any kind of set of actions that, you know, one government takes is going to be highly dependent on what others do, what other governments do. And we see that even in our own, even within the states.
Yeah.
So the complexity of these coordinated responses that cut across so many different factors, so many different departments, whether it's, you know, CDC, the health plus the economic, I think that seems to me to be quite unique in this case and a different level of uncertainty.
I also think the speed is different. You know, like, I mean, it felt like the global financial crisis happened quickly, but it didn't really in the grand scheme of things. This one is more event-driven, kind of more like 9/11 was, where one day to the next, we woke up and part of the world had changed. And I think the comprehensiveness of this one, where literally from a few weeks to another few weeks, you have this thing across the entire country. Even in the global financial crisis, a person in Ohio still got up and didn't think they were going to catch some disease in a mall, right? So the fact that it was across every industry, every state at the same time, that felt to me very, very different. When you look at how CEOs try to index that kind of experience, it's easy to say the simple stuff, conserve cash, you know, but how do you draw from like going through the crisis in 2008, knowing there are issues on issues and then issues that relate to the new issues and, you know, there's a whole bunch of consequence management stuff and things like that. Where do you start and how does the past kind of help you adjust to a new normal? Help us understand a little bit how you could use prior experiences. If you were giving advice to a new CEO, hasn't been through one of these before, what would you say?
Well, I think, as you pointed out, you know, the whole focus on cash, I mean, those are kind of table stakes. But I think that has to go equally with communicating with the organization, your organization, and with customers, that there's such a heightened level of uncertainty, anxiety, that if you're going to manage through this, and even in some cases, I think the question might come, even, you know, there might be opportunities that result in this. Mm-hmm. You need to address the anxiety that's going to be in your organization. And you need to make sure that you keep key talent and a team that can work through this. So I think it's better to over-communicate, mm-hmm. Particularly with employees, to be transparent. A couple of good examples that I've just heard recently about founders, CEOs making it a point to, you know, share some of their uncertainty and their unknowns, but also share with, well, how they're going to tackle it, mm-hmm. and what this means to people in the company. And it doesn't change any of the uncertainties, but it certainly helps to make the team feel like, okay, the leaders are being transparent with us, they're going to be upfront with us, and yeah. If it comes down to that, there needs to be some shared sacrifice, whether that's, let's say, a temporary work reduction or pay cuts, then leading by example, number one, and also being transparent about that goes a long way to keeping the team, you know, and the group intact. Mm-hmm. And I think those companies come out of the back end of this in a stronger position.
Well, I think their people trust them better. You know, like, people are smart. I think the management teams that say, oh, don't worry, everything's going to be fine, nothing to see here, we're going to be great, we're going to pass, they see through that. Like, they read the news. They know that there's probably a lot you don't know. So I totally agree. The more transparent you are, and it's okay as a CEO to admit, hey, I don't really know how all this is going to go, but I have ideas on how we're going to handle if this happens or if this happens or if this happens. So at least you communicate to them that you're thinking about different alternatives.
Yeah. And here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. And here's when we're going to sort of communicate to you next and keep you in a loop.
What do you do about, like you said, stable questions like product launches, hiring plans? How do you handle investors in a thing like this? Looking back, how did that happen when you were in the crisis before, and what would you tell folks now?
Well, I think a crisis like this forces you to focus on your fundamentals and your strategy. So there's a list of what you need to do and, you know, what everybody wants to do, what you'd like to do. And you've got to narrow that down, you know, pretty quickly, whether it's mm-hmm. projects, product launches, even organizationally. Mm-hmm. So if you do need to pare back, if you do need to, you know, preserve runway, you're focusing on the things that are core, and either putting on hold or shedding those things that are not. Mm-hmm. And that's tough. It's really tough to stop projects or delay product launches. But I think that's the importance of the scenario modeling and understanding what things may put you in jeopardy. If you have a major mm-hmm. capacity expansion and it's going to take X amount of, you know, cash or funds, but by doing that, you may put yourself in a situation where you remove all financial flexibility and the ability to weather 12 months more of this storm, then that's probably not something that you ought to be doing, or at least that's a board level discussion, and you better understand the risks of that. So I think the bottom line is you need to really understand the the risk balances of some of these decisions or the growth plans that you had prior to this crisis, and then see if they still make sense, or did they put you in an untenable situation?
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something there, because like you might have run into the crisis with a growth mentality, either from your investors or double, 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 triple, or whatever you're trying to do, which is what attracted maybe venture money to you in the first place. But then you shift to here. And like you were saying, you might have a growth plan, but that growth plan might drain your cash down to under 12 months or something. And you don't really know, or you're not comfortable knowing exactly when you may be able to get another round done. So your margin for error drops. Like, you don't want to put the company into a ditch that it can't get out of. So boosting the margin of error that you might have in case maybe that product doesn't hit the way you'd like, or you can't launch it because of, you know, COVID or whatever. So peeling back on that just for a second, you know, you mentioned communication. Does that exist upward as well? You mentioned, you know, get a board level decision. Do you over communicate that way as well?
I think the board is going to need to feel, at least in my experience with the boards, particularly of smaller companies, they need to feel that they're very much informed. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, I can speak to in certain countries, the board actually has quite a bit of fiduciary responsibility, mm-hmm, and liability. In that case, then over communicating or very precise communication where they feel informed and they're making the best decisions on behalf of those shareholders, yeah, they've got a sort of a double duty. So I think that's absolutely critical.
I think some CEOs pull in their horns a little bit in that regard, because they might have brought those investors in based on a whole bunch of really rosy scenarios that may now be out the window. So they, you know, what we've seen a little bit of in this crisis, and we've worked with our clients to avoid, is kind of lowering that communication and not wanting to admit that, well, maybe our plan is out the window. But I think what you're saying is you have to do the opposite. You need to be very open with them as well and make sure they understand where the business is. I mean, they know you CEO, you didn't cause COVID, right? So it's unlikely they're going to lay this at your feet.
But as a CEO, it's very likely that you may need some, you know, more operating bandwidth or forgiveness, let's say, on some of the commitments pre-COVID. If you think they're going to be, let's say, detrimental, or put the company in a risk position that it can't afford. Yeah. And yeah, you're going to need some folks on the board to sort of support that and run cover for you. So whether it's the whole board, whether it's, you know, a couple of people on the board that you might have the ear of, it's going to be important that at least a couple of champions on that board understand maybe a more nuanced position around why delay this, or why maybe change this plan from a, you know, a pre-crisis view.
Mm-hmm. And how early do you do that? I mean, it's a little late now, but we may still be on the earlier side of a longer term thing. Are you on the phone with those guys, you know, day one, or do you let it roll out a little bit? One of the things I've seen and experienced myself is that sometimes people wait a little too long to do that. And then the board feels, like you said, they feel kind of behind the ball, and that you didn't really spring them in. So your experience as well, that like sooner is better, both downward into your company and upward to your board?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the board goes, you know, my operating mentality is it's not good to surprise board members.
Generally, to be avoided.
Exactly. Right. Now, hopefully that's not an epiphany to anyone. Right. And so the bias then is, sooner is better, even if it's simply to say, look, this is the way we're thinking about it. These are implications. Here's the work in process right now. I think even just letting the board know that you're focused on the right questions,
right,
buys you credibility, even if, and I think it's almost not to be expected that you're going to have all the answers, because the bottom line is right now, nobody knows what the answers are to a lot of these things, because right, nobody can accurately predict, is this a 3 month or 3 year right now scenario, mm-hmm, that we're looking at? Mm-hmm. And so I think what's critical early on is to let the board know, these are the couple questions that we're focused on specific to our business, our industry. And then here's when we're going to have guidance around mm-hmm, how we handle this stuff.
And like we were talking about before, I think it's important that the CEO be honest in those conversations. Don't overpromise. Don't paint some sort of rosy picture. Oh, we're going to be fine, right? Because that will turn around and bite you if things don't right, work out the way you want.
Right. And along those lines, don't feel obligated to provide an answer for every possible question.
Right.
Because I think you're going to end up overreaching and it's going to bite you.
I mean, you were, I think you mentioned in, and we've talked in the past about your roles at a very, very large firm with very established procedures and probably akin to turning aircraft carriers versus canoes. How would you contrast a crisis level response in a Fortune 500 firm with, say, a typical Berkman client, which is a venture-backed startup with, you know, anywhere from 5 to 50 employees?
Well, in a Fortune 500 company, you've obviously got a huge amount of resources to potentially deploy. You know, you, assuming you're in reasonable financial shape, you've got levers that you can pull, probably access to financial markets that you're simply not going to have in a smaller situation. So I think in that respect, you know, it's a lot more difficult for smaller companies. On the other hand, as you just pointed out, you could be far more nimble.
Right.
You know, you've got much more direct lines of communication. I think the communication that you have with your employees becomes even, I'd say, even more critical, because chances are that folks in your group are going to have to wear a lot of different hats.
Right.
People are going to have to step up in ways that maybe they're not used to. And you're very likely going to need people to do that.
I think, you know, and like you said, shoring up your capital base is probably the biggest deficit when little companies are trying to make a go of it versus a big, huge firm like some of the ones that I think you worked with earlier on. The rest of it, though, is sometimes a real advantage in this kind of environment, right? Like pivoting to opportunities or moving the company more rapidly toward one of the scenarios. Did you run into, in prior context, did you see that difference highlighted in trying to get things done inside a large firm versus some of the companies we work with now?
Yeah, well, I would draw on some personal experience with a smaller company that was in a bit of a turnaround situation, not created by global crisis like this, but
a crisis nonetheless, right?
It was a crisis nonetheless, and one that required, you know, some pretty urgent action, and if not done, was going to put the survival of the company at stake probably in a matter of months. So moving quickly in that sort of scenario was much easier in a smaller company. One, explaining to, at least in this case, the chairman, a couple of the board members, look, here's what we got to do, and we got to do it quickly. That could happen in a matter of days. And then going ahead and executing on parts of that plan, some of it done, you know, while you're actually doing the planning. But it was much quicker to execute in a case like that than if you're with a, you know, a large company with lots of layers of, you know, bureaucracy and in fairness, different departments whose task it is to be involved or overseeing some of these things. So mm-hmm. You know, that was certainly an advantage on a smaller scale.
And you can get a decision in a day, theoretically, versus having to wait 2 weeks for somebody to probably to vet it. And one of the counters that we've heard on that, and I've experienced as well, is, well, yes, but all of those people and all of those resources in a larger firm are bumpers on the baby carriage, so to speak, because they're very smart and they're all very experienced and they have the ability to protect you from yourself. But that by default means that they move more slowly. So any moments in prior crises that you can recall where the avenue that the firm needed to pursue actually ended up opening doors that you wouldn't have otherwise seen or opportunities that wouldn't have otherwise been seen? And no is a possible answer. It's okay.
No, yeah, I'm just thinking of going, this is actually going back to a larger company experience where there was a, I'd say, a self-inflicted, you know, financial situation for this one division. And in effect, what it required doing is hitting the reset button. So what opened up to both customers who knew there were issues and even internally where the group had pretty much lost its legitimacy, mm-hmm. that by a new leader came in, and I was sort of the key person on that turnaround team, that we basically got a chance to hit the reset button and take the company in a, you know, healthier, or that division in a healthier direction, mm-hmm. in a way that would not have probably been possible before. Now, it caused mm-hmm. a lot of pain. But in that kind of case where it's sort of a turnaround situation, I think you get kind of one chance to basically hit that reset. And particularly, you know, well, with employees that you want to retain, but also largely with the existing customer base. And they get a sense of perhaps an unhealthy situation, what's going on, the trust is not there. So you get one shot to basically say, hey, here's the direction now, here's the new team. And in some cases, and we did this, you do a bit of a roadshow, almost like you're going to potential investors, you know, on a roadshow. But in this case, you're doing it with some of the major accounts and major customers. Yep. and you explain some of what went on, but more focused on here's why this is good for you, this direction, and here's why.
And this is what we're doing.
Makes sense. And we want to retain you, your loyalty, and you as a customer. And then if you execute on that, a few moments that follow, you know, you can build some pretty good loyalties. But again, I think the key there is you only get one shot to do that.
Right. Right. Do you think a roadshow like that is valuable now in this kind of environment, even with a small company that does have large accounts, maybe an enterprise SaaS business? Do you go when you can, of course, when the laws allow you to do it? Do you go around and do exactly what you just said, even if it's not a company-specific crisis, but a macro one?
Yeah, you know, my only pause with that question is, I think in a turnaround or more localized crisis where your audience is experiencing something more normal,
right,
it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think. But they're in crisis probably too, right?
That's right. And so my only concern is, you know, in this environment, aside from the logistical issues of, I do think it's much more effective to be in person in some of these mm-hmm. things. But even that aside, it's that likely everyone along that chain in that industry that you're in is experiencing some sort of a, you know, disruption. So to go around and say, hey, here's what we're going to do for you, and here's why everything's okay.
Here's how we're going to survive.
So I think that has to be done very cautiously.
Probably a case-by-case kind of thing, right? You'd have to be careful there.
I think a lot of people are being inundated right now by all the ways that Company X or Company Y are taking these actions mm-hmm. in recognition of the pandemic. I mean, everybody's doing something. So there's a lot of background hum there to begin with.
I've seen some companies do also say, look, we know everybody's in a world of hurt right now. We're going to go ahead and, you know, extend your subscription, or we're going to lower a price. And they have taken the longer view. And of course, this only works if you have the financing for it, but they'd rather lower their margin and keep a client than have the client go out of business. So they try to do whatever they can to help them get through. And then talk about buying loyalty, right? I mean, if a company needs your product and you help them keep it through a downturn that they're in, they're never going to forget that.
Yeah, I think that's a different story. And I think if those are meaningful actions that actually help you to weather this, then I agree. Yeah. I think that builds loyalty. I think if they're more public announcements about demonstrating that, yeah, you too take it seriously, then it's a little bit more difficult to mm-hmm. say, gee, wasn't that terrific?
So let's go to the other side now, like looking back on your career and other crises that you've been in. Does any major mistake come to mind, or a misjudgment that you might have seen a CEO make, or a board that you maybe didn't know at the time, but you would say, well, if we had to do that over again, we might have gone a different direction? And does that change how you advise your clients now?
You know, one thing that I've observed and I've experienced myself when I look back and say, gee, what would I have done differently? It often has to do with, boy, I wish I made that decision sooner than I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think Agreed. It's easy to sort of fool yourself and say, or to use as an excuse, I just need some more information and then I can make this decision. And what you're really doing is you're sort of shying away from the uncertainty or the risk of making a difficult decision.
Yeah.
But it doesn't change the fact that not making that decision might be equally or even more risky. So this idea of sort of waiting for more information or you know, thinking the uncertainty is going to go down is a big watch out. And typically, you know, I've experienced a couple times where a year after you've gotten through something, you look back and say, boy, if I had made that decision 6 months earlier, couldn't we be in a better position?
Yeah.
And I think in order to do that, you have to really separate what is an existential risk. Boy, if I get this decision wrong, it's going to wipe out the company or force us into bankruptcy, versus a recoverable one where I'm going to look foolish and it's going to be obvious that I made the wrong call, but I'm not putting the company at risk.
Right.
And on those, you know, my bias would be the bias for action. Take the action, because even, you know, you're going to be right, whatever, 9 times out of 10, 7 times out of 10, whatever it is. And collectively, those things will put you in a better place than trying to be right all the time.
Yeah. And like you said, waiting for the perfect information in a crisis never happens. It's a perfect recipe for paralysis. And that's when you really get in trouble, because you don't go left and you don't go right. You just sit there.
Right.
And in a crisis situation, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was move. Like you said, make a decision, understand what you know, understand what you don't know, or how can you avoid the low probability, high impact risk, and how can you maneuver toward, you know, the reverse of that, where you actually have a low probability of a low impact and a high probability of a high impact.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of younger CEOs that this is their first time around, and I, especially with the nature of this particular crisis and how widespread it is and frankly terrifying in a lot of ways, that's a big thing. They don't know what to do. You know, they're just kind of standing there like, I don't know.
And if you're a younger company, if it's the first time dealing with a crisis like this, you've got a great growth plans, you got a bunch of projects. The idea of having to either mothball or just cut completely some of these projects, you feel like, oh, I'm cutting off, you know,
right.
I can't live
without
that.
Which might have been your whole life for the last two, 3 years, right?
Well, yeah, or some of these might be pet projects and, yep. And you know, the reality may be that you've got to prioritize, you've got to cut some of those. And which ones, you know, do you say, do you not fund? And I think, you know, those are not existential decisions. So those are ones that probably need to be done rather quickly.
Yeah.
And if you delay those, then you could end up really burning up resources needed for other possible scenarios that are a little, let's say, less optimistic.
Because cash is still king at the end of this. You need as much runway as you can so you can hold your breath. The other thing I'd say to that, when you make a really good point, is those decisions where a CEO doesn't really feel that comfortable making the call, get your board involved. Bounce it off of them. Get their buy-in on it so that it's not just one lonely CEO, but also the board is backing your decision.
Right. Agreed. If I'm going to go to the board with those kinds of what I would call operational decisions, and I think it's important to go there with a, here's what I'm recommending and here's why.
Good point. Then, certainly on the existential ones. Like if you're, if you're talking, well, we used to make dog harnesses. Now we're going to make, you know, enterprise SaaS equipment, you know, some sort of like major pivot, that you need the board all over that stuff. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's really the hallmark of a good team, a good leadership crew, is that you've got folks that you're confident know the difference between recoverable and existential, and they're gonna escalate the ones that are on the existential side, right? And right. I agree. Same thing then with a board level discussion, that you know those major shifts need to get filtered up, but not in a way, not delegated up, but
escalated
yeah. and engaged, so that those folks have the opportunity to share a different perspective, or you know, as is their prerogative, say no.
So like the pivot idea, that brings me to another question is, in your experience, like as you start to recover out of the crisis, another hallmark of a good management team and a good CEO is they have their radar up for other new opportunities, investments. What's your sense there? How, and this is a subjective, so of course it's hard to know right now with everything so in flux with the crisis, but is looking for opportunity a day one thing? Is it a 2 weeks after you feel like you're stable thing? And I don't want to steer it. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, some of the best companies and the biggest companies that we deal with right now came out of the 08, 09 crisis, yeah. Right? They were nimble. They didn't hesitate. They seized opportunities. They bought competitors. I mean, those folks are the ones we talk about every day. What do you think about that concept?
Yeah. Well, obviously, if your ship is sinking fast, you know, it's probably not the best to be saying, how do we squeeze 10% more horsepower out of the engine?
Right.
But that aside, if the economy contracts by whatever it is, 5%, well, 95% is still functioning.
Right.
And so there's still absolutely big opportunities out there. And my answer is yes. CEOs, leadership teams, they should be looking for opportunities, and particularly because I think that this also is somewhat unique with this pandemic. It's almost certainly going to change in a permanent way everything from consumer behaviors, yep. long-term government policies impacting
commercial real estate,
supply yep. chains, employee safety, healthcare policies, on and on and on. And those changes are going to have to impact, you know, the way that we work, and they're going to create opportunities in probably ways we don't even quite imagine yet. So there's no question that in those changes, either old industry or legacy industries are going to find new ways to do business. They better yet if they can anticipate some of those. And there's probably going to be new businesses that crop up in specific response to some of these changes.
I mean, which opens up another hole of that already, right? Yeah. I read a thing the other day that Zoom believes about 3 years worth of adoption was squeezed into 1 month for their video platform. Not most, but a large number of people are now very comfortable and very familiar with video conferencing, which they would not have been without this crisis, right? So there's, where do you go with that as a company that maybe is in that business? We have clients up and down the chain that are now figured out how to like reduce their expenses. And if they had to do a reduction in force or whatever, they did that. And now they're kind of like looking out like, all right, how can I use this? It sounds weird to say that, but what opportunities might be there now?
You know, cultural change for companies, big and small, is really tough.
Yeah.
The change is even more prolonged, I think, for larger companies. But when you have an external event like this, sort of a shock to the system, you know, that cultural change, which becomes almost necessary for survival, happens pretty quickly. And so, yeah, I think adept companies, large and small, will use that as a sort of a catalyst for positive change in a way that might have taken them years to do, if ever, because people would have resisted it. They may encounter a lot less, you know, resistance to some of those things now. There's going to be some winners and losers in that.
Sure. But the old saying, you know, fortune favors the bold. And if you smell that sort of opportunity, CEOs, you guys, you know, make the effort you need to make to at least run it down now quickly before somebody else comes up with that same idea or figures out the same market opportunity that you might be sensing, right? Again, get your boards buy in and all that. But I think there's never been a crisis I've gone through now, which goes now back further than probably both of us would like to admit, where there were not real winners that emerged out of whatever we were dealing with, right? I can remember after 9/11, remember even a couple of years after 9/11, no one was ever going to live in Lower Manhattan ever again, right? And that ended up not being the case. And the people that were able to move quickly were able to fill demand there that they then were very happy to have 5 years later. So I think there's, you know, lots and lots to say about that kind of thing. But on just one last thing, I think there's also every company's moment when they feel comfortable enough to focus on that kind of stuff is going to be different. So there's really like no magic ball that says, okay, 6 months after the start of the crisis, you should be looking at opportunities, right? It all depends. But having that radar on, I think, is really important.
My guess is that virtually every company with a supply chain cutting across borders, international borders, is going to be reevaluating their supply chain risk, redundancies, you know, that in good times, redundancies may look like excess and waste. In times like this, it looks very smart. But how do you strike that balance? But I think that's going to be happening across the board. It's going to be fundamental shifts in whether it's supply chain, sourcing, manufacturing strategies.
Headcount, right? Office space, everything. Yeah.
Where you have people, how your people communicate. Yeah, I think there's going to be major, major shifts. And even you might even say, how do you impact some of those things in the absence of clear government policies or positions or coordination across, you know, between government? Where just because two countries may have a political loggerhead in some issue, you still got to get goods in across borders and through customs. And so how do you still make those things happen and function?
Well, listen, this has been awesome. Love these kinds of conversations. You and I talk about this kind of stuff offline of the podcast anyway, but this has been great. Thanks again for joining us. This has been another episode of Berkman Insights, our podcast series on lessons learned from prior downturns. And we've been speaking with Dan Rosenbaum, who's one of the New York area CFOs at Berkman Associates. Thanks again for joining us, Dan.
Thanks.